Lunch with Leon.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Lunch with Leon. Happy New Year, and this is our first episode for 2026. We went out with a bit of a bang in 2025, and I'm glad so many of you enjoyed my interview with Simon Lederman, or to be more precise, his interview with me. Not only did we have lots of people downloading it here on audio, it was available on YouTube as well. Lots of people watching us on YouTube. We might try and do some more YouTube interviews in the future. It's not possible to do it for every episode, but we might try and do some more because we know that you like it. And of course, it helps us get to a different sort of audience as well. Lots of people, though, tell me they like it on audio because they are listening to it as they're walking the dog, taking their exercise in the gym, on their commutes, and so that's the reason why they like it on audio. So we will always make sure we're there in audio for you. So just for this episode, because it's been the Christmas and New Year holiday, I'm going to bring you another conversation I had on another podcast. And this is with Thomas Abelman, who across on his Freewheeling podcast has a whole series of interesting guests. So back on his podcast towards the end of last year, we had a discussion about bus policy. And although it's been available on Thomas's Freewheeling podcast, in case you didn't hear it, here it is with me.
So I'm with Leon Daniels, and we are going to do something that we probably should do a lot more than we currently actually do, which is to look back at a past policy announcement and check in on how it's doing. And we're planning on doing this across both our podcasts, because back in 2021, both our podcasts, we reviewed the National Bus Strategy the week after it was published. So now, 4 years on, it's time to look back and see what's happened. Leon, that National Bus Strategy, do you remember that?
I do remember it. And of course, it was a product of that interesting period, wasn't it? When Boris talked about loving buses and playing with model buses as a child, and various odd other bus-related stories, which in all the years we worked together, I never actually remember him saying. But that was the precursor to Bus Back Better, the National Bus Strategy of 2021. And given when it came out, which was, you know, relatively soon after the COVID lockdowns had really come to an end, I think we all thought it was rather good because we were in COVID recovery mode. Passenger ridership numbers were down, and we weren't quite sure how many of them we were going to get back. So I think we rather liked the idea of the National Bus Strategy.
I mean, in one sense, it's the most extraordinary indicator of how the world has changed and how volatile our politics is. I mean, when you look back at it now, it was bus lanes on every street where there's space to have it. It was making sure that buses were at the absolute center of transport strategy, making sure that the buses were prioritized above cars, reissuing guidance to take that effect. I mean, it was, given that we now have a Conservative Party that, you know, is questioning even the validity of net zero, and yet it was the Conservative Party 4 years ago that was writing this. I mean, it's kind of disorientating how quickly things have changed.
It is so. And I think we were amazed. For me, the bus service improvement plan requirement was the one that perhaps was the biggest surprise, because that was £1 billion and every local transport authority was required to produce one. And I think we all knew in our hearts that wasn't anything like enough money to pay for all the improvements that every BSIP would claim. But we were still surprised, and there were some very good BSIPs as a result of it. And there's been some areas of growth, which was amazing. There's been areas of growth in places with weak BSIP, like Thurrock. There's places where, as a result of BSIP, good BSIPs, there's been some good improvements. But it was, at the end of the day, £1 billion. And I think we knew it wasn't going to go far enough, but we mustn't turn our nose up at that sort of money from government.
No, I think that's right. I mean, I look back at what I wrote on my blog when it was published. This is the day after. And I wrote, so as someone who's waited all my life for the government to issue almost exactly this document, why do I feel a tad uneasy? I think because the guidance makes it all sound so easy to achieve such big things that require so much money and so much effort, and yet doesn't really acknowledge any of this. One's left with a niggling worry that when it all gets difficult, the ambition will just evaporate. That's what I wrote immediately afterwards.
Indeed. And we're seeing it now because there is a school of thought, you and I have both heard it, that the improvements that are required on the transport network, the costs associated with certain sorts of franchising, and the desire to go to net zero, there isn't enough money to finish that job.
They were remarkably prescriptive in the National Bus Strategy and the BSIP guidance, weren't they? Well, one of the things that was sort of slightly bizarre reading it, because you know, we'd had at that point, 12 years of a Conservative government. The Conservatives generally pro-market, you know, pretty light touch on regulation. And the National Bus Strategy and the guidance that accompanied the BSIPs were, you know, things like you mustn't have letter suffixes on bus route names.
Oh yes, I'd forgotten that.
I mean, it was a very odd exercise, because it basically was, here is exactly how buses must be run. And by the way, I actually, yeah, letter suffixes, I'm going to make an exception for, because I think Brighton did a lot of that and it seems to work fine there. But in general, it was all sensible stuff. It was all the right things to do. So it was this kind of slightly bizarre exercise of every councillor in the country having to rush to hire a very small pool of consultants to write up back to the government exactly what Andrew Gilligan had described as the ideal bus service being, in order to win a slightly arbitrary share of £1 billion. It was a slightly eccentric, it felt like the kind of game show that the BBC might commission after the traitors, you know.
Indeed. And in fact, that was the drawback. It was so prescriptive that I don't think it gave anything like the latitude that different regions of the United Kingdom needed, because it broadly applied across urban and rural, the deep West Country and East Anglia. It was, I'm afraid, so prescriptive that you can certainly see why it wasn't carried through. But also my big worry is it did put a huge burden on local authorities. And the drawback there is, of course, that they've been hollowed out to such a huge extent. There's just nobody left in many of these local authorities with any transport planning experience. There's people there without operating experience. In fact, it is argued that in some local authorities, you know, the people that do the consultations, the people that do planning inquiries and feed the cat are the one same person. And therefore, BSIP put on them a huge responsibility for which the only answer is to spend money on consultants. And there is a drawback with bringing consultants in, he said, speaking carefully as one. The drawback about bringing consultants in, if you're not careful, you don't get any knowledge transfer, because they come in and do the job for you and then they leave. In which case, the people left are no better off than they were before they started. And so I was sad about that, because it didn't unlock the gate quite in the way that we might have wanted. And we've over the years broadly seen a sort of slide back a bit, and the BSIP money has been used for various odd other things now as well. And some of that money has been swallowed up in maintaining existing stuff instead of improving things that would have made a change. And the other thing that it didn't do properly, and even the current bill, the current act indeed, doesn't do properly, is it doesn't cure the problem of the fact that it is the highway authority that unlocks the problem to do with congestion, to do with traffic speeds, road speeds, and all the rest of it. And, you know, even in London, we weren't the highway authority for most of the roads, although we did control the traffic lights. The fact that none of this has given highway authorities an obligation to press this forward and improve road speeds, which is like one of the elements. Price is clearly an element in terms of the attractiveness of public transport. Speed, therefore frequency, etc., is the other one. And we know, don't we, that we could provide a very much better service, faster service, more reliable service, cheaper service if we had free run on the road, and we don't. And too many local authorities apply the 2004 Traffic Management Act as an obligation to get as much traffic through a corridor as possible, where in fact, actually, what the Buses Act could have done and what the policy paper didn't do is to tell these highway engineers that in fact, it's not the number of vehicles you get through the corridor, it's the number of people.
Number of people.
And if if you do it by the number of people, then by definition, the bus passenger gets a good deal out of it. So the 2004 Act is badly interpreted, and this legislation, the policy paper and the legislation that followed it, didn't do anything for that. And I am afraid, and I'm not the only commentator on this, you know, there are operators and authorities spending the thick end of £500,000 on an electric double-decker bus to travel at walking speed in our cities.
Unfortunately, all that is right. And I'm going to read you one other. This is the last time I will read you a paragraph from my blog of 2021. So I'm not going to keep doing this, don't worry. But in the week before the National Bus Strategy, I wrote a post on what I hoped would be in it. And what I wrote was, the bus strategy must focus above all on the management of the road network, on housing policy, on infrastructure investment, and above all on taxation. It shouldn't actually focus on buses. The decisions on the list above will determine success far more than any policy decision on buses. And I think that was absolutely right, because exactly as you said, the number one thing is the management of the highways network. If you don't end up with buses being able to get somewhere effectively, it doesn't work. Infrastructure and housing investment, if you go design places that buses can serve reasonable density with reasonable access to the places where people live in reasonably direct line, it doesn't work. And of course, taxation relates to the fact that we keep cutting, in real terms, road prices, fuel duties, and we've never introduced road pricing. And all of those things, actually, you know, I admire Andrew Gilligan's insistence that we shouldn't have suffixes on route numbers, but there are things that are more important. And unfortunately, the really big levers that make a difference for a bus strategy weren't pulled. And even if they're hard to pull, you and I have both been responsible for the writing of strategies in the past. Even the things that are hard to do, you don't have to do them instantly, but you have to acknowledge them and start to set a direction of travel for solving them. Whereas it very much felt like those things are too hard to do, so we won't do those things. Let's focus instead on what we can do around making the management of bus networks better, which perfectly valid, but it wasn't really a bus strategy because it didn't focus on the things that make the big difference to buses.
No, indeed. The other one that was a surprise to me, which, of course, at the time we understood it in a way, the £2 fare cap.
Yes.
Is an odd instrument to deploy off the back of a strategy, because it came in January 23. Of course, a £2 bus fare is quite different in one part of the UK to another. There were some extraordinary long-distance express services that would allow you to go to the seaside for £2, which was remarkable. And of course, in some cases in urban areas, the single fare was higher than that. But it was a funny, blunt instrument, I thought. And I was a huge skeptic. And as we know, it was only introduced for a limited time, and it got extended to the end of 2025 at £3. As it happens, shows what we know, it seems to have stimulated some growth. And it's an odd, as I say, it's a blunt instrument. I thought it was hugely unscientific, but it seems to have had an effect, and probably an effect that a government might have wanted it to, which is a sort of simple to understand. Your government's chucked some money in, the maximum fare then only £2, £3 now. That seems like a good idea. Good old government. I will go and fill my boots with £2 bus rides. And it had some success. The drawback, of course, for me is that, a bit like heroin, once you're hooked on it, and in the case of the bus operators, hooked on the income that you get from the government to compensate you for the fare you're not charging anymore, you're stuck with it. And if that funding doesn't continue and fares an arbitrary date at some point in the future where the cap is lifted, all that work will be undone. And it will be the cold turkey of the bus industry if that funding is withdrawn, because everybody will then just see it for what it is, which will be a massive fare rise for many journeys across the network. And I think, A, the industry is hooked on it. Of course, who wouldn't be? And it also plays to one other area, which is, since we now know in England that public money of one form or another is at least 50% of the overall income, then no wonder the public wants more say in it. And no wonder the government is going to tell you not to have suffixes on your route numbers. And no wonder the government is going to tell you about all the things that you should be doing, because the taxpayer is paying at least half the cost of the operation.
So I'm going to take your faint praise and damn even further, I'm afraid. I am even less enamoured of the bus cap, the bus fare cap, than you are. I think, yeah, the first thing is just how it was done, which is just so emblematic of the short-termism that certainly affected the last government. And I think it's too early to say whether we're going to see a huge improvement with this government. Early indications are that it's not the same level of short-termism, which is good. But as you rightly say, it was introduced for 3 months and then repeatedly extended. Imagine the marketing that would have been possible if you were told at the start that you've got it for this amount for this number of years and that amount for that number of years, and you can really promote that. But it was virtually unmarketed because there's no business case to market something for 3 months. The second problem I have with it is that it was only a cap on single fares, and so it made single fares much cheaper than period and multi-operator passes, the result of which is people migrated away from the things where you have any kind of loyalty relationship, any kind of marketing data, any kind of incentive to use another bus after you used the one, made the one journey you have. So it in many ways incentivized all the wrong things, the behaviors we wish not to see, and the exact opposite of how most commercial businesses would act, where they're trying to encourage customers to use loyalty products where they have a marketing relationship with them. And the third is, well, yeah, if you cut the fares, you will get growth. I mean, that's like, yeah, always going to be the case in any supply-demand relationship. But the arbitrary nature of a bus fare cap, I mean, I spend a lot of time in Folkestone with family. And in Folkestone, if you want to go east or west, you go on the train, and the nearest towns are in one direction, Dover, and the other direction, Hastings, and the other direction, north, Canterbury. Canterbury is on a frequent bus service, the other two on frequent train services. And I'm going to make it up because I can't quite remember the precise numbers, but it's something like 20 quid to go to one, 30 quid to go to the other, and 3 quid to go to Canterbury, because Canterbury you go on by bus. And it's just arbitrary that it happens to be that the railway to Canterbury was closed back in the 60s. And so now that's a bus route. And therefore, suddenly that particular roughly 1 hour long intercity connection is a bus service. And my final in my list of complaints is the fact that the bus fare reimbursement is also slightly arbitrary. And actually, many of the better bus companies that are able to charge higher fares have seen their income reduce because of the way the reimbursement works, yeah, and have struggled to know what they're going to be earning in the future and haven't been able to invest in maintaining the quality that they had. And that also feels like a real shame.
Indeed. And you and I both know, don't you, if you play around with some of the market forces like pricing, you always create odd quirks out of the system. There are always unintended consequences if you mess about with the laws of economics. And I also can't put away the fact that I was just back in Brisbane, where, as you know, physically segregated bus priority measures, speeds of up to 50 kph between stops, all in underground tunnels in the central business district. So attractive terminals, fast journeys, and they put the fare down to 50 cents for an hour's bus travel. And the ridership growth is 13%. And some of that's induced demand, you know,
yeah,
it's not
absolutely
drive demand. So at 50 cents in a highly, highly restricted area, still isn't driving the demand, which tells you that the problem is much more complicated and sophisticated than you believe. And I've just been asking a couple of questions in one or two forums where, as part of pressing forward to improve public transport services, there are some heroic growth numbers in the assumption. And the test question has to be, are there really enough people who are prevented from using public transport, ready to travel, if only the price was better, the frequency was better, the quality, you know, all the things that would cause you to change your mind? Because it is entirely possible that there just aren't all those people waiting to travel for any one of a dozen reasons we could think of, to do with age, to do with location, to do with working from home, to do with health, all sorts of things. I have seen some heroic growth numbers, which doesn't mean you shouldn't try, but actually you've got to be very careful producing a business case that assumes that ridership is going to go up by a huge factor as a balancing number to make the business case look good, only to discover downstream that demand actually isn't there. And you've got the investment and you've got the fares mix right and you've got super duper new buses and there's an app that allows you to know where they all are and all of those things. But before you get to any of those places, are there enough people wanting to travel? And are they wanting to do the journey that you're seeking to provide? And I don't think we're clever enough to know that yet.
No, and of course, part of the problem is that those are not fixed things anyway, but it takes time. So, you know, if you give people enough confidence that a new route exists and is secure and is going to run forever, people will change their jobs, people will change their shopping habits, people will put children into schools they wouldn't otherwise have put them into. And over time, demand that didn't exist previously will materialize. but it certainly doesn't happen quickly. And it relies on that policy stability that has been so lacking recently, which is why, you know, there was so much in the National Bus Strategy that I enjoyed. I loved reading. I mean, I agreed with every word. You know, I was kind of out on the rooftops shouting and chanting Andrew Gilligan's name. You know, it's amazing stuff.
But you're not the only person to have done that, but not for the same reason.
The problem was there was that element of it not actually being a strategy, because it didn't have a long-term plan to get you to exactly what you've just described, which is markets that didn't previously exist emerging and becoming stable as a result of a change in their environment. It was a
indeed so.
Rush as fast as we can and see what happens. And that's what ended up occurring.
Indeed so. So, you know, I'm also going to mention in our little tiptoe through memory lane, of course, one of the things the 2021 paper promised was the Bus Centre of Excellence. And you know I'm going to mention it because I chair the advisory board. So,
I do indeed. Drumroll, hold on a minute. Wouldn't you rather I just sort of drop this in? Now, there was one other bit from the National Bus Strategy, Leon, which I think was particularly important and has been the starring success of the whole implementation. Could you tell me about the Bus Centre of Excellence, please, Leon? Isn't that the kind of intro you'd rather?
That's much more than what the intro I'd like. And I was delighted to be asked to chair the advisory board. There's a quite separate project board. The whole thing is housed inside the Chartered Institute of Highways and Transportation and continues currently to have funding from government. One of the biggest jobs, and by the way, in the paper, I'm not entirely sure the drafting of the paper fully understood what a bus centre of excellence would be. It's a snappy sort of title, and it seems like a good idea, but there wasn't much substance behind it in the paper. And frankly, there wasn't much substance behind it in the subsequent discussions. So clearly it was a commitment and it had to be formed, and it was formed and now operates. It's found itself a rather nice place, which in particular is dealing with the complete lack of skills inside local authorities. And to some extent, the lack of bidding, franchising and those sorts of skills inside operators who are faced with franchising for the first time. Then add on top of that the cross-fertilization of good practice, which was clearly needed. So the Bus Centre of Excellence has found itself a rather good niche, and it is doing, and of course I'm going to say this, aren't I, but it is doing a good job in those areas, and I'm very glad that it's come out the way that it has. It does a very good program of events, a very good program of training sessions, and is alive and welcome. And of course, is really the place where the operators and all the other stakeholders are able to get together in a forum. And when the Bus Centre of Excellence speaks, it doesn't get the reaction that a trade association can get, which is, well, you would say that, wouldn't you? So I think it performs a very good function. It doesn't replace the Confederation for Passenger Transport, which does a very good job, of course, for its members and lobbying for government. Bus Centre of Excellence's job is not to lobby government. It is to provide a service. And I'm very pleased with how that has developed. And we are looking forward to our funding being continued after it expires in 2026.
Excellent pitch. Very impressive. And if you want to get involved with the Bus Centre of Excellence, what do you need to do?
Just go to the website. It's very simple. But just type in Bus Centre of Excellence. You'll find the team. You'll find all the opportunities, everything you can do, what's available and so on. So just go to the website and the team will be the team.
Fantastic. So seeing as we're talking about the things that have gone well, after being somewhat critical of the fare cap, one of the things that actually wasn't in the National Bus Strategy at all, bizarrely, but it had occurred simultaneously, was CRSTS, City Region Sustainable Transport, and the fact that we've now got long-term funding grants for pretty much all the metropolitan areas and some other areas beside. It doesn't cover the costs of running buses, which is a bit of a shame, but in terms of some of the issues we were talking about earlier around infrastructure investment and the need for a long-term plan, and the fact that the bus strategy, the bus service improvement plans were so rushed, the fact that you've now got some transport authorities able to plan a pipeline of investments is a huge step forward and somewhere we've not been for a very long time.
I think so, although of course there are some notable omissions from people who don't get that funding, even though they're reasonably sizable combined authorities. So the distribution is not very good. But again, like we said earlier, we can't complain too much about the availability of public funding, because if you're rude about the funder, then they stop giving you the money. So we should be grateful there is the availability of this. I do think, though, it opens a wider question. And in fact, it came up at the bus summit that we did at the Bus Centre of Excellence, which is that many city mayors continue to make this case for raising more money locally and wanting the powers to raise money locally in various forms. And, you know, you've heard me say loads of times in the past, this government has been very good about devolving 100% of the responsibility and 80% of the money. And I'm talking education, health, social services, and anything else you can think of. And of course, when you have the ability to raise money locally, two things apply. One is you tend to find as you raise money locally, central government reduces how much they give you because they don't want you having extra money. They just want you to have, they want them to be able to be blamed by the local electorate, not the central government. But also, if you just turn around and think about that as a taxpayer, well, frankly, whether it comes out of my income tax, whether it comes out of my road tax, or whether it comes out of my local council tax and precept, actually doesn't bother me that much because it's going out of my pocket regardless. And I truly don't believe the average person thinks that because the money is being deducted through local fundraising, they don't mind paying it in a way they did mind paying it to central government. I'm not sure they're bothered. They just want to pay less. And of course, in the current climate, and we're recording this ahead of the budget that's widely trailed to increase more direct taxation, I think the public won't be terribly fond of raising more money locally, even though the mayors are calling for it, any more than was just recently discussed, the probability of the introduction of road user charging pay per mile to replace vehicle excise duty, certainly for zero emission vehicles and possibly for others, because it's just seen as another tax. And I think local fundraising will be seen as another tax, because at the end of the day, the only people who pay are people like us.
I think the issue you raise around if you raise the money locally, you just lose money you would have received centrally is such a fundamental problem that we've got to get out of. I obviously bang on about Switzerland a lot, so I'm going to bang on about Switzerland again. But you know, their transport is funded in Switzerland from their infrastructure levy, which is, you know, a dedicated pot of taxes, defined taxes that in perpetuity are dedicated to transport. Those you can therefore, you know, you could obviously those tax receipts could rise or fall, but they're all relatively stable ones. And you could say in 2029 or 2039 or 2099 what roughly will be available to spend on transport, because it's just those taxes flow straight into it. And therefore, if you're a local leader and you want to get even better transport, you can raise some local taxes, knowing that you can look your voters in the eye and say, this is what you're going to get. Whereas, you know, I was talking to Tom Forth on the podcast last week about why it is that actually northern mayors who are desperate for better transport haven't even used the powers they've got, you know. And we still only have one workplace parking levy actually live, and it was introduced 20 years ago, despite that being a power available throughout the country. But exactly as you say, why on earth would you take responsibility for raising money when all it'll do is come out of your next grant, in effect? And it is very frustrating that the Treasury has such a reluctance to allow this kind of tax hypothecation for things that have very long-term investment cycles.
And indeed, we could apply this to rail and highways as well. All you need to know as a highway industry or a railway industry or a transport industry is a rough drumbeat of X billion adjusted for inflation every year for the next 10, 12, 15 years. Of course, that funding, that's an average. There might be more in some years and less in others, but broadly over the length of time, because the only way the rail industry, the highway industry, construction industry, the transport industry will properly invest is if it knows roughly the amount of money it's going to get every year without fail. We don't need to know what we're going to spend it on. And there's a debate to be had downstream about whether you use that money to build one super spectacular project or 20 smaller ones. You can have all those debates. But to your point, just reserved every year X billion for those industries that it can rely on so that it can plan its supply chain, its apprentices, its raw material supplies, its labor force, skills, and all that sort of stuff. As I say, we don't need to know what we're going to spend it on. All we need to know is that is going to be forthcoming, because then we can make some really good plans. And surprise, surprise, some of the people, some of the markets that we rely on, like house building and office building and hospital building and prison building and all the stuff that goes with it will start to fall in line with that, because we'll be ready to cope with the changes in demand that will come. And of course, people will be pleased to work in places and pleased to live in places because they know the transport is always going to be there.
And in the unlikely event that there is a senior Treasury official listening at this moment, I will talk directly to you, because this is such a fundamental point. We spend about 40 billion a year on transport every year anyway. We always have and we always will. But at the moment, we spend it inefficiently. The unit costs are high. We don't get much for it. If we had this certainty, costs would come down because the private sector would invest in making things cheaper. They would have a long-term pipeline of projects that would mean that they were able to make one-off investments that then can be repeated. And as you say, Leon, we would increase the revenue, which means that passengers would start to pay for more of the costs of transport as opposed to the Treasury being on the hook for it. The biggest single driver of cost inflation in this industry is the Treasury in trying to reduce the cost of the industry, which is very frustrating.
Indeed. And of course, we mustn't forget, especially if the Treasury is still listening after what you just said, is that in all the cases that we put forward, all the cases for funding, the way the Treasury looks at things is quite different to the way you and I plan our household budgets or our holidays. The Treasury test is, if we didn't spend this money, how much worse would life be? And if the answer is, by not spending all this money on highway maintenance, there'll be 5% more potholes, the Treasury is minded to say, well, we won't spend the money then, because life will only be very slightly worse than it is now. So this isn't about how to make things better. It's about how to not spend money so that the amount of the condition of the asset or whatever it is only very slightly smaller. Life is only very slightly worse. Nobody will ever notice, because of course that's its way of not spending money. Which, of course, then has led to the situation, you know, we find ourselves in now, isn't it? Which is that people are facing, as I say, possibly in the budget, a rise in direct taxation, which reasonable people might swallow if they thought it might be spent wisely.
Absolutely.
But since broadly they don't trust the government to spend any of their money wisely based on decisions such as the ones you and I have just been discussing, they resent paying it. I wouldn't mind paying higher fares, say people. I don't mind paying higher fares if the service was better. I don't mind paying higher taxes if there's no waiting at my local doctor's surgery. I don't mind paying higher taxes if little Johnny can go to the school around the corner. What always happens is that we pay the extra taxes and the waiting lists don't get shorter, the school situation doesn't get any better, and the bus fares still go up.
Absolutely. So long-term, dedicated, predictable funding. If you're a mythical civil servant still listening, it would make the most enormous difference to unit costs and to revenue, which overall will drive financial efficiency. One other thing that we haven't spoken about yet, which I think is just worth talking about, which the National Bus Strategy didn't cover at all, but in terms of things that can make a difference and can reduce costs and increase revenue over the long term, though not the short term, which is where these things are always difficult, is, of course, integration and modal integration. Because as a country, we are extraordinarily modally siloed. It was a national bus strategy. We have currently got a railways bill going through Parliament. I couldn't help noticing when I read the railways bill, which bizarrely I did, that the GBR has to take into account a railway strategy that the DfT is obliged to produce. Despite the fact that they're literally in the middle of producing an integrated national transport strategy, there is no reference to having to consider the transport strategy, only a new railway strategy that must be produced. The railway strategy being a statutory document by definition of existing in this bill, and the transport strategy presumably not being. And so each mode has to live or die on its own and is managed on its own. But of course, as we all know, they feed each other. A bus passenger arrives at the station and gets on the train and pays fares on both, or if they don't connect up, does neither, but the service still has to be paid for.
Indeed. What a surprise that people manage to travel on more than one mode. It's extraordinary. Anybody would think they would go shopping in a high street and go more than one shop. It's extraordinary that people feel that way. And you're right that the whole thing of integration is not well done, other than perhaps in the fares and ticketing element to it. But again, that's caught up because much of the fares and ticketing integration is caught up in the no man's land between bus and rail and indeed other modes of transport. You know, I've campaigned long and hard since I was young, I think, about how frankly the bus plus £2.50 add-on ought to be the default rail ticket
to the cities and where it is. And you used to have to opt out of it by going and standing in a long queue in a ticket office, because all those cities wouldn't be noticed in the rail fare, but in fact would provide bus travel at the destination. And guess what? When people think they're getting something for nothing, of course they're not, they're paid for it. But as soon as they know they're getting something for nothing, they tend to use it. And we would have much, much higher number of rail passengers interchanging into bus at the destination end. And the revenue could be apportioned much the same way we apportion senior citizen funding. And we would get more passengers out of it. We get more integration out of it. And in fact, passenger demand would drive the integration, because there'd be many more rail passengers wanting proper integration with bus as part of doing the deal. It was impossible to do. I had one or two quite serious jobs in my time, got nowhere with it, because rail people are not interested. Bus people would like it, but they don't know how to make it work. The government nods and smiles and says, oh, we'll take it as part of the reform of rail fares. But it never quite makes it to the top of the pile. And so apart from in the fares and ticketing area, really the policy paper had nothing about integration. And I can't help feeling also that sometimes civil servants think that integration must be something to do with the app. There has to be an app. There
just absolutely must be an app. Yeah.
By the way, I've got Roger French's words echoing in my head, because he is one of these people too. It's not, it has to be an app. There just has to be an app to do this. If there's not an app, it's not going to work. And integration will come out of using some sort of magic app, which, as it happens, allows you to travel on more than one mode, reckon it all up, and charge you the cheapest possible fare at the end, but also gives you the integration information about how you transfer from one mode to the other and so on. But that's not quite the point, because all the app can do is tell you how bad the integration is and how you're going to wait 28 minutes for your bus, because the last one just left 2 minutes before the train arrived. The app isn't going to cure the integration problem. All it's going to do is describe what the choices are. And what you and I are talking about, as I've seen your presentation on the Swiss model, that's the sort of integration we want, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And the Swiss have made it work. And it's taken them decades to get there. So I'm not saying this is easy stuff. It isn't easy stuff. You know, all the incentives. We have DFT that's organized modally, and the entire industry follows, and have been since the 1920s. And the P&Ls are managed independently. And of course, you know, for it to meet up, then you know the train and the bus timetables probably need to become a little bit less efficient. So the costs go up. But then passengers can make journeys that they wouldn't otherwise have been able to make and pay fares on both. But those fares probably ideally should be integrated as well. And so you've got to attribute those fares to recreate those P&Ls. And actually, then wouldn't it make more sense to not manage the P&L separately, because they're now so intertwined that separating them out becomes harder? So this isn't easy to do. And it's organizationally difficult to do. The actual bit about putting a bus stop outside a station and writing a new timetable, that's easy. It's the organizational stuff, the cost attribution, the decision-making that makes this difficult. But part of the trouble is that a lot of people, I mean, you genuinely, what you said earlier is genuinely right. There's sort of slight astonishment that people can use more than one mode, because I've had a surprising number of conversations with relatively senior people who have said to me, well, integration is it's a good objective, but it's not a priority. Because when you look at the data, most people only use one mode.
Well, that's because the integration is so poor.
Exactly. I mean, it's the classic joke, you know. There's no demand for a bridge across the river because no one currently crosses. Well, of course they don't. I mean, if you can't integrate between modes, and the most basic thing about having to pay two fares, you know, if it's even at a £3 cap, £3 to drive to the station, and then when you get there, the train's not for another 47 minutes, or you can just jump in the car, which will cost you literally pence, even if you have to pay £3 to park at the station, well, of course you'll do that. So you know, the most basic level of times and prices we don't get right, so no one does it. And then we say, well, no one wants to do it, because if they did want to do it, they'd be doing it now. And we've got to get out of that mindset.
No, we have. And some work does have to be done on interchange, because unless we're going to have exceptional dwell times at interchange points, the interchange is only going to work in one direction. Because if people on the bus are going to catch the train, then the bus has to arrive before the train goes, and therefore the people on the train won't be able to get on the bus because it will have come first. So some of that's relatively easy because of peak flow. Some of the other ones are more difficult because you really, unless you're going to add long waits for one mode or the other, it is only going to operate in one direction. But for goodness sake, we've got the latest AI and super powerful computers. We can work all that out very easily. We can tell who is most likely to benefit from the right direction of integration. And therefore, there will always be some cases in the opposite direction that don't work. But it doesn't matter because the majority of people will get a better service out of it. And I think we can easily work with that.
There's also one very interesting thing about the Swiss model that it's worth remembering, which is always very counterintuitive to people here, because we've all been brought up on the idea that it's only about journey time, and the journey time is measured by how fast a vehicle moves. But actually, they do have a lot of pausing and hanging around and dwell time in Switzerland. You know, trains will wait for large periods of time for connections to occur. Buses will wait for large periods of time for trains to arrive and then depart again. Lots of vehicles spend a lot of time in Switzerland not moving. But here's the kind of alchemy of all of that. The journey times for human beings become much quicker because you get on a bus, it takes you to the station, you wait 3 minutes, you get on the train, you get off the train, you get on another train, you go where you're going. You're constantly moving but getting on and off vehicles that spend a lot of time hanging around. You have to kind of scratch your head a bit, but then say, oh yeah, that's absolutely right, isn't it? But it requires that mindset shift. And it comes right back to the point you made about the highways management. Highways do it badly, but let's face it, public transport people do it every bit as badly of managing and monitoring and metricizing passengers and people as opposed to vehicle movements. And we do exactly the same. Everything we do is about how fast is the vehicle, how many vehicles are we getting up this piece of track, what's the punctuality of the vehicle. As soon as you start looking at those things from the point of view of the people in them, you start getting to very different conclusions about what good looks like.
I know. And isn't it interesting, everything that you've just said about thinking about the passenger, the people, that of all the subjects that was covered in the policy paper and the debate we continue to have, if you go to any trade show, exhibition, conference, who are the people that get most interest? It's the zero emission bus technology people.
Absolutely.
And their supply chain and their apps and what data can do for you and all the rest of it. And people in this industry have spent a huge amount of time loving every minute of this what's the best way to decarbonize debate. The passenger isn't in this. They're not in this at all. You and I both know passengers will not, for example, pay higher fares to travel on a zero-emission vehicle, even though they themselves might have very green credentials in the way in which they run their lives and take their holidays and run their homes and turn their central heating down to 60 and so on. But the science and this move to zero-emission and the charging infrastructure and the power and the smart charging and the software occupies a huge amount of our industry's time on, frankly, a subject which the passenger only has the smallest interest in. Ask 100 passengers whether you'd like a zero-emission bus. 99, of course, would say yes. Ask them, would they be prepared to pay another £2 to travel on it and help the environment? No.
One of the things that I would have liked to be able to do properly, and I didn't get the chance to do properly, but I did sort of my own fag packet calculations, but when I was at Transport for London and the Mayor of London was pressurising for a 2030 deadline for the London bus fleet to be entirely zero emission. And that required a significant acceleration of the purchase of zero emission vehicles by operators and therefore funding from TfL that was, you know, we were struggling to find. But I did my own fag packet calculations around what actually the cost of the decarbonisation, you know, per unit of carbon removed, because it's only temporary, it would have caught up eventually, and what that money could be spent on to decarbonize faster. One, I couldn't convince myself it was anything other than a spectacularly inefficient, financially inefficient way of decarbonizing. And secondly, I couldn't convince myself that even if you weren't going to put that money into a better form of decarbonizing entirely outside transport, if you were going to spend it on transport, the best way of decarbonizing would be to run all of our vehicles for as long as you possibly can, as efficiently as you can, and make the service as attractive as possible and get as many people onto public transport out of cars and then replace everything in its normal timescale. And I'm talking here not from the point of view of what's best for transport. I'm talking about what is best for decarbonisation.
I can believe that. I can absolutely believe it. But of course, in the black and white world of politics, we're now in diesel bad, electric good, even though a Euro 6 diesel engine is frankly miraculous in terms of its energy efficiency and the extremely low level of pollutants that it creates. But of course, it's become binary. diesel bad, electric good, and therefore we must try and hit some deadlines, which of course is exactly what the industry doesn't want, because none of the manufacturers want very full order books and be forced to add capacity into a market that, once this job is complete, will sag back to where it was again and will find itself without enough orders because the UK bus fleet has been renewed in a shorter space of time than might otherwise have been the case to meet these deadlines, and as a result of which nobody needs anything for a bit. So I think it's a pity. I go back to my point before. If you interfere too much with market forces, you always get unintended consequences. And therefore, to your point, if we choose not to run our vehicle fleet to the end of their life, but introduce artificial deadlines to replace them sooner, then actually you create all sorts of problems downstream. And as you just said, doesn't actually necessarily decarbonize faster anyway.
Okay, so let's see where we've got to. So National Bus Strategy, 4 years on, some good stuff has happened. But it's happened at great cost. The National Bus Centre of Excellence is a triumph, especially the advisory board and the chairmanship of it. The strategy didn't really have longevity, and the priorities that were set largely were superseded even by its own government. There is, however, money going into buses still, both through the combined authorities and directly. We're a bit worried, though, that some of it's ring-fenced to the wrong things. The bus cap isn't really the best use of it, we feel. Zero emission isn't the best use of it, we feel. What we'd much rather is just a big slug of money handed out with certainty, with long-term commitments, and for competent, capable professionals to be able to make a decision on how to allocate those funds. What have I missed in that?
I don't think you missed anything. I think that's a very good summary of where we find ourselves all these years on, from you standing on the rooftops and cheering Andrew Gilligan's name for the residents of Walthamstow.
It became a habit.
Indeed. So, well, and of course, your Mini Holland scheme, of which you've talked about on this program.
Yes.
With Clyde Lokes. You can also see from your rooftop, so I can think of every reason why you might be on it. But it is important to review these things. My old Chinese chairman, T.T. Choi, dead now, he once gave me a very good lesson. He just said the answers to all the troubles of today are contained in our history. And I think that's a very profound comment. I think it's very important that we do what we're doing now, which is to look back over progress, not because we want to slow down the progress or go backwards. What we want to do is to learn the lessons of the past and try not to make the mistakes again in the future. You can only be partially successful with that because governments have a habit of repeating the mistakes more than once, but actually so does the population. So I think, you know, going back and looking at this and thinking about what worked and what didn't work and what should have been in it and so on. And if we think about some of the shortcomings in the progress, just as you've described, Thomas, the fact is the policy was to some extent superseded by one of the several Conservative governments that followed the one that was in place in 2021, only then for the decks to be cleared again for the Labour government that we have now. And therefore, you can only try your best in these to make as much progress as you can and set a direction, which is why if only the longer-term drumbeat of funding could be sorted, then it wouldn't so much matter the colour of the government because the trajectory was strong. And then you could just nuance around what you did with it for political as well as any other reasons. You
know? Yeah, I think
that's where I would be.
I agree. Let's end on that note for our Treasury official, who I understand is probably still avidly listening. For our Treasury official,
he's got a few more now. He said, "Listen, tune into this.
Summon them all around. Absolutely, they're all in a little circle with their ears glued to the loudspeaker. And I think the one thing that we want to leave them with in their huddle is we're not asking for more money. We are not asking for more money. All we are asking is to look back at the money we spend every year. Just do an average." Last 5 years, last 10 years, last 20 years, we always spend the same number of tens of billions on transport. All we're saying is just accept that truth, commit it, make it certain, tie it to some kind of defined formula so that it has a sense of longevity, and then watch the magic happen.
Absolutely so. Absolutely. And long may we continue to find supporters in that area, Thomas, because we need to continue to press in this direction if we're going to make the progress that we need to make. And I'm going to end on something else, if I may.
Please do.
Which, very quickly, just to say, as we get into franchising over the next 2 or 3 years, many of the combined authorities, one way or another, will make a commitment to franchising and take significant steps towards delivering it. So in about 3 years' time, there will be quite a number of perhaps seven-year contracts operating in our many cities. So we're casting forward 10 years now to 2035. I just wonder, with the advent of technology, autonomy, and other social change, what this landscape will look like in 10 years' time.
Yeah, no, we've got to stop soon. We've got to stop. But another call out. You know, Treasury, you can step back. This isn't for you. But one of the things I would really love to see is a bit more ambition, actually, from some of our transport authorities in this country around autonomy. I know you've been to various places where autonomous vehicles are in use. I spent time in Oslo looking at the program there, which is the largest in Europe. Low-density suburbs don't work for public transport except at high cost. We're not going to rebuild all our... I think we should build far more gentle density developments. That's a really important thing. We're building the wrong houses at the moment, but we're not going to rebuild all the cities we already have. But autonomous vehicles have the ability to create a kind of extraordinary reverse beaching in which you can reconnect all these places that have lost their public transport over the last half century back into the mainstream public transport network affordably. Now, that's a hypothesis. I can't tell you if that's true or not, but there's enough evidence that it might be true that I would love to see some of the more ambitious transport authorities, the Manchesters, who've got the resources, who've clearly got a desire to create something. Andy Burnham often talks about wanting things to be London style. Well, here's a chance to do something before London even gets to it. And you know, the urban environment in a place like Manchester, you know, this is how you connect those suburbs of Salford and Wigan directly into public transport. Will it work? Can't be sure. Lots of reason to think it might. Other cities are experimenting. Waymo are coming to London. I was in a workshop with someone from Waymo last week. You know, they are here. Robotaxis from Silicon Valley are here. Autonomous vehicles don't have to be the US car-centric Silicon Valley, everyone on their own model. We can make a public transport version of it, just as we don't only have to have cars. We can have something called buses, which do a collective form of the same technology. But we've got to start running the trials and learning and experimenting. And I'd love to see some more of that happening here.
So, Thomas, should we say goodbye to the listeners and carry on talking?
Yeah, good idea. Yeah, absolutely. Great talking to you, as always. Dear listeners, and yeah, let's go down the pub and carry on.
This interview was first broadcast on Thomas Abelman's Freewheeling podcast. Available wherever you get your podcasts from. Lunch with Leon is produced in association with Passenger Transport Magazine. Please send us a review or a rating. We will be back with another episode soon.